From the Lynn DeGrant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 11th day of October 2024. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets in today's USDA report. We'll do that with Mike Zuzlo at GlobalComResearch.com. We'll continue that conversation in Commodity Week when we'll be joined by John Zanker, Risk Management Commodities, and Logan Kimmel of Roach Ag Marketing. In the closing market report, however, we'll pick up the conversation from yesterday we were having with Gary Schnitke about how to handle low income on the farm and some of the things that you might consider this fall and going forward. And then as we finish out our time, at least in the first half hour, if you can stay with us all the way through the hour, you hear both of the programs. But through closing market report, we'll start the conversation with Eric Snodgrass from Nutrien Ag Solutions about the weather forecast, and we'll talk just a little about that drought out west and his concerns as it's related to next season, all on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
December corn for the day settled at 415 and three quarters, down 2 3/4. The March at 433, 3 1/4 lower. The May contract at 441 and three quarters. It finished down 3 1/4 cents. November beans at 1005 and a half, down 9 1/4 for the day. The January at 1021, 10 1/2 lower. And the March at 1035, down 11 1/2 cents. Bean meal off $1. The bean oil 43 cents lower, and soft red winter wheat down 4 3/4 at 599. The hard red at 604 1/2, down 6 1/2 cents. Live cattle futures were 70 cents lower. Feeders down 15 cents for the day, and lean hogs were up 70 cents. Crude oil at $75.60 a barrel, down 25 cents, and the wholesale price of gasoline at $2.12 4/10 per gallon, up 2 9/10 cents per gallon on this Friday afternoon. Mike Zuzlo now joins us from GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas, on a busy Friday with the USDA reports. How'd you make it through it today so far, Mike?
You know, pretty good, Todd. I was a little bit frustrated with the world numbers for the wheat. It seemed like to me that USDA's report didn't really coincide or corroborate the wheat trade's view, and certainly my view, that we've got a global drought that's not theoretical, that it's actually practical, it's real, and it's cutting bushels, especially in the Black Sea, but probably also in Argentina and also in Australia and maybe here in the United States, depending on the acreage base that we end up with. But they didn't see it that way. However, right before the close, or about a half an hour before the close, news broke on the news wires that internally Russia is telling their exporters not to sell wheat below $250 U.S. FOB. That would be compared to 220, 230 that they had set minimum floors on for their wheat sales on export front, a few months back. And that really did bring the market back to positive. You could really see that reaction in the news wires, headlines in the price, and ended up, you know, being able to stay above Thursday's low in the soft red wheat. So good overall when it comes to the report and the market reaction. We'll be very curious to see exactly what shapes up in South America. In that, while I agree with a lot of people that the center west Brazil is looking like a big pattern shift in terms of a rainier situation and right in the nick of time, to me, Argentina still looks very dry in some key areas that could impact, again, wheat and corn, too.
Were there any numbers on the global side for corn and soybeans that you found of interest? And we'll go through the numbers here in just a moment from the United States, but start with those global numbers on those two commodities, too, please.
Yeah, we are still the lowest since 2015 in world wheat ending stocks at 257.7 million metric tons. We're still carrying a little over a 32% stocks to use ratio. That's a 10-year low. Corn ending stocks, 306.5, only about 2.5 million tons higher than where we were in 22-23. Stocks to use went down 0.2% to 25.1. That's a 10-year low as well in terms of stocks to use. If I said that on wheat, I meant to say low. Soybeans coming in very burdensome again, highest since 1994. In ending stocks of 134.65, actually going up a fraction. that keeps your stocks to use ratios almost 33.5%. Again, the highest since 1994, which I would define as kind of modern times. So that's why I'm using that number.
So let's transition that into the numbers USDA released for the crop production report here in the United States. I want to start with the soybean because there wasn't much of a change there. They did drop yield to 53.1. That's down from 53.2 bushels to the acre. Residual was down 2 million bushels. And essentially, they finished off with the same ending stocks now for soybeans that they did last month at 550 million. They didn't change the season's average cash price at $10.80. However, you're telling me on the soybean side globally, while we have a big number for carryout in the United States, we also have a burdensome number on the global side. How much of a concern is this to you?
It's a big concern. I mean, it's still the leader to the downside, both domestically and globally. I think that's probably the most negative part of the report on Friday was the USDA did not cut the bean yield with all the anecdotal evidence that we've heard around big areas around east of the Mississippi River and these low seed moisture levels, these low bean moisture levels. And I think the trade was very disappointed by that. And you could see that in the reaction in terms of the corn and the beans, in terms of the market has been buying corn, selling beans. I think the trade was ready for a reversal of that spread type mindset, but it just locked it in again with both the domestic and the world numbers. I'm at a 52.4 yield right now. If the rest of the harvest finishes like I'm hearing by producers that I work with, I could go below 52. And I feel pretty comfortable with the 513 carryover, and I could even take it below 500 million. But does that really help? And that, I think that's the big question mark, especially with China out there and looming. You've talked, you and I have talked a lot about the Chinese demand, and you know their meal prices just continue to slide. And we really took a beating in our meal prices here this week as well. And I think that's probably in part because of China's meal price and also because of the hurricanes in the southeast poultry and livestock markets. I got to think that that meal leading the downside this week before the report had something to do with the feed side of the equation.
And their economy appears to be continuing to struggle.
Exactly. And the big bazooka type stimulus is expected this weekend. I pretty much told clients a weather pattern that we just discussed, Argentina not maybe getting a weather pattern shift, and then this bazooka potential in China. I want to see how we look Sunday night, Monday. So far, the charts held up when it came to the corn and wheat as we closed out this week.
USDA put the corn yield at 183.8 bushels to the acre. That's up 2/10 of a bushel. Ending stocks now, once you rolled in the lower number that came from the ending stocks last year, is 1.999 billion bushels. Nice to see it under 2 billion. Will it help?
I think it will. And I think the biggest issue, and we talked about this last month, USDA did it again. They cut the old crop ending stocks 52 million bushels. And so between July and October, 3 months, we've lost 337 million bushels, almost 20% of our carryover. I just feel like that's way too sloppy in terms of statistics, and I think that's going to show up in the cash prices eventually, and I think it makes a big difference if these world stocks stay as tight as they are right now, and I think this is where this South American weather pattern change needs to happen, especially in the corn market, because USDA took our exports up 25 million bushels. So I agree with a lot of their numbers, but that old crop carryover number is really disappointing because we could have used a 1.76 billion bushel carryover back in July. I don't think we would have had to visit those low prices that we just came off of.
All in all, what do you think will happen with the market going forward?
Yeah, I'm still thinking the wheat's the leader. The wheat's got the weather market that's real. It's not theoretical like corn and soybeans in South America. I think the crude oil market is still well underpinned at this point. And with this Chinese stimulus, I think the path of least resistance, harvest pressure in corn and beans can be easily offset with either wheat or crude oil. So that's what I'm going to be watching next week.
Any final note from you?
I think the biggest thing to watch here, Todd, is the idea that the dollar market and the crude oil market has not really played a role. I'd expect that to play more of a role as we close out the month.
Thank you much.
Thanks, sir.
That is Mike Suzalo. He's with GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. Gary Schnitke now joins us to continue a conversation we started yesterday about an article that he and his colleagues have written, posted to the Farm Doc Daily website this week. It's entitled Perspectives and Strategies for dealing with low farm incomes in 2024 and beyond. Yesterday, we outlined some of how farmers have arrived, and it's just not individual farmers, but all grain farmers across the United States have arrived at a precipice of really low farm incomes. The projections from the team for this marketing year, for the 2024 calendar year, in fact, is to lose $30,000 in income. That's a net loss, no salary at all, coming off very, very large incomes from previous years. And now they need to figure out how to deal with this. Gary is here to talk about that. Hi, Gary. Thank you for being with us. You write in the article about some strategies that you and your colleagues believe farmers can use to help them deal with these low returns. I think it's important to start with the one that they probably cannot use. And that's just plain outright marketing or trying to hit a home run when they're marketing their crops.
Yeah, so our first strategy is realize there's no way out of a way to market yourself out of low returns, because we have low prices, and there's not much evidence that farmers can time market sales. So in fact, there's negative evidence to that impact. And if you can time market sales, just time market sales and don't bother raising the crop. But and that's difficult. There are some ways to differentiate oneself by producing differentiated grains like non-GMO or food grade corn, and using on-farm storage for post-harvest marketing opportunities is also a reasonable strategy. Some farmers will find that either one of those isn't their way to go, and they can make that decision quite reasonably. Just generally, low incomes, low prices are here to stay, and we would suggest something along spreading marketing sales across the year. So you're not going to hit a high, you're not going to hit a low, you're going to hit the average. But that's generally it. That strategy will reduce risk.
So what can they do? What are the things that you and your colleagues have identified beyond the couple of things you've mentioned, GMO and diversification, food grade corn, those sorts of things? What other kinds of things can they do?
Yeah, no, we would say that all these are straightforward, well-known, and yet difficult to implement. So just so we set that up. One is to be a low-cost producer, and we do, looking at FBFM farms, differences in costs that persist over time. And those farms that have lower cost on either, however you measure per acre, per bushel, typically have higher returns. Some of the things we would sort of say look at now is particularly look at fertilizer applications, make sure we're in university levels, realize that fungicides now have to have more yield to justify their application. So maybe take a look at those. And overhead machinery are other areas where we see farms have differences in cost. Our next strategy would be to take every government payment that's out there. We know that some farmers don't particularly appreciate those, but if you're a young producer, you're placing yourself at a disadvantage. So we sign up for ARC and PLC. Those deadlines are March 15th. We would suggest taking crop insurance at a high level, RP at a high level, and think about taking ECO and SCO this year and take a look at that. That's not a slam dunk, but take a look at those items. Delay capital purchases. Finally, also develop them. Farm rental strategy, and this is particularly important for younger producers. Make sure that farm is well known in the community, have a farm resume and talking points for differentiating oneself, but also determine what you're going to pay for cash rent. Cash rents are up there, and taking a high cash rent picking a farmland and paying a high cash rent can actually destabilize a farm. I'd also suggest preparing a cash flow. Find another source of income, which is another thing that most farmers have done, some sort of off-farm income or off-farm business. Many farms have a great deal of business acumen, entrepreneurship on that farm. Think about those other businesses. Finally, and this may seem counterintuitive, build in the expectation for buying farmland in the future. When we look at farms today, the ones that are most financially solid are those that have a land base. And that's just the way it is. So over time, we should be thinking about increasing that own land base. That's always difficult. We're not saying that there's not a chance that farmland prices decline, but building in that expectations is something that we think producers need to think about, even in these times. I mean, that farmland does make that land, that farming operation, more secure when it's paid for.
I think you had a couple of suggestions about the things people and farmers needed to do when they were going to plan for that as well. Do they need to have capital set aside?
Yeah, so we're going to do purchase farmland, we have to have financial resources to do so. If you're a young producer, think about taking advantage of FSA loan programs, which can lower the interest rate. And in general, no matter if it's debt financed at over 50%, and may in fact be lower than that, that the repaying the debt is going to be a cash outflow for the first several years. So having some other source of funds to cover that that land purchase is important as well.
A couple of things for this fall that producers can take care of. You mentioned anhydrous ammonia and fertilizer applications. In-rate calculator is what you search for on the web. That's in-rate calculator. You're looking for actually a site that is entitled cornratecalc.org, and that'll give you a maximum return based on the price of corn and the price of nitrogen to the nitrogen. Not the highest, but the maximum return to income. So that's one thing. And then soil test to try to figure out where everything is. And if you're high on your phosphorus and potassium, lay off of that until it is needed. And then, of course, we've not mentioned this, but you would argue, I'm sure, that they need to talk about cash rents with their landowners.
Yep. I mean, again, those cash rental discussions are difficult, but we saw cash rents on average go up $40 between 2020 and 2024. Coming down to the 2020 levels would be, in my mind, good, but that's still not going to get us to a profitable return. We need to have those cash rents go down below that, given our projections. So we'll see what happens. But yes, beginning those discussions would be a good thing.
Thank you much. I appreciate it, Gary.
You're welcome, Todd.
Gary Schnitke is an agricultural economist on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. You can read the article we've been discussing on the Farm Doc Daily website. It was posted on Tuesday of this week. It's entitled Perspectives and Strategies for Dealing with Low Farm Incomes in 2024 and Beyond. And this topic will be taken up during the Illinois Farm Economics Summits, as well as the Farm Assets Conference, which includes all the presentations made in the IFAS series. You can find links to those on our website as well. Look in the calendar at the moment. They're December the 13th. That's the Farm Assets Conference. And then the following week, the IFAS series on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday in Mount Vernon, East Peoria, and DeKalb. Let's check the weather forecast now with Eric Snodgrass. He's with Nutrien Ag Solution. Really, we're going to check out kind of the climate with him because there is just a whole lot going on. Eric, thank you for being with us. Let's start with the wet area in the United States. It's easy to spot because it's where the hurricanes have come through, Helene and Milton, kind of in the same places, or partially anyway. Can you talk a little bit about that first place?
Yeah, I mean, what was first was Francine. Don't forget that one came up the Mississippi and made a turn down there as well. So you've got this massive disparity across the country where we have places in the Midwest and upper Midwest and plains that have not measured precipitation since the beginning of September. And then you have places that have now set new all-time records for precip. And of course, we're still dealing with the fallout from Helene and just the tremendous amount of damage from flooding that produced. And then, of course, earlier this week, we watched Hurricane Milton go across Florida in about 7 hours, and along the way dumped 10 to 15 inches of rain on its northern side, tremendous storm surge damage, avoided another massive disaster in Tampa with respect to storm surge. It's amazing how close it has come. But you add up these two hurricanes and the damage they've done, and we're probably looking at those two alone, maybe when it's all said and done, looking at $250 to $300 million. Just those two hurricanes alone, which is going to be substantial. And I could be wrong, but those are just some of the early estimates. So while all of that's happened, and we've just seen tremendous devastation in the areas that have been hit so hard, the rest of the country's like, where's our weather? And it's largely been very warm, and it's been very dry, with only very short interludes of cooler weather, like we had a couple of mornings this week. But the reality is that we've got some extremely dry soils. It's promoted some very fast harvest. We've had issues of major wildfires in the northern plains. We had some fires in Illinois. And the amount of dust that's in the lower atmosphere just because of all of this harvest effort has given us some pretty spectacular sunsets. And also we had the aurora in there as well. So Todd, you pick your poison. Where do you want to go next?
I love the sunsets. Last night's sunset, I just happened to be out at that time and could look across to the southwest, and it was beautiful. It was just an orange and gorgeous sun. Those who were in the combines, as long as they had a view, had a spectacular view, if it wasn't blinding, and it didn't seem to be so. So it was fantastic. I tried to check the aurora borealis out, but just am too put into a wooded area that I couldn't catch it, and too much light probably as well. That was too bad. Did you get a chance to see it?
My wife and daughter did. My son and I were at a soccer game till late, and then we had to get home and get some stuff done. I had to get that kid to bed, and so I did see it though back this summer, and it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. But you know why you can see it? Why have we been able to have viewing of all of this and these spectacular sunsets is because we've been under high pressure for weeks, Todd. I mean, that's why it's so dry. Nothing has come in to displace the giant ridge that has existed from the southwestern United States clear to the, Great Lakes at times. And that's what's promoted this dryness. And it's not just dry, it's record dry in places. Throughout the Midwest, Great Lakes states, upper Midwest, plains, we've got some locations of the driest we've observed since 1893, when our records really began. So that drought's got me concerned, Todd, about the longer range, because when you have dryness, you have to overcome the deficits before you can even get real precipitation back in to start to break things. And so we have questions if that'll occur.
You may hear the answer to those questions from Eric Snodgrass by visiting our website at willag.org. That's willag.org. There you'll also find our Commodity Week program recorded on Friday with our panelists, including John Zanker of RMC, that's Risk Management Commodities, and Logan Kimmel of Roach Ag Marketing. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.